I'm Russell Mills, and this is KRMG In Depth, the podcast. Thanks for listening. The conversation you're about to hear took place on November 11th of 2020 as twin crises continued to unfold across our country. COVID-19 numbers setting records for cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And meanwhile, the drama of a presidential election that's seemingly in limbo has people wondering, what's next? So to find out what's next on both of those topics, I spoke exclusively with U.S. Senator James Lankford. Here's our conversation in its entirety. We are on with United States Senator James Lankford, and the first thing we have to talk about is the ongoing pandemic. Oklahoma's numbers are not pretty. The national numbers are not pretty. We're heading into a holiday season. I mean, but I know that help is on the way, and there's I'm thinking short term and long term. So let's talk first about a possible vaccine, because I'm thinking that's more of a long term thing. I'm thinking mid next year before it's really available. Am I crazy?
So I hope you're not crazy on that, but you are correct on the issue of numbers are increasing in Oklahoma, but they're increasing all around the nation. I talked to one of my fellow senators yesterday that's in New England that was saying how high their numbers were spiking in New England. So this is not an Oklahoma issue. This is a national issue. It's also a worldwide issue because there are multiple areas where it's spiking worldwide. So we just got to be able to pay attention to this and can't let off just our own personal care of ourselves. That's the short term. You're right, we're getting into holidays, and a lot of families are trying to figure out how they're going to do holidays without actually seeing each other face-to-face and what they're doing. I know that's an incredible, painful choice that some families are making, and that's tough. Short-term on this as well, though, that'll be out in the next month. When that comes out, the target right now in distribution is for all the highest need individuals. That would be nursing homes, people with highest comorbidities, healthcare workers. All those folks should be able to get that by the end of the year. That's 50 million people of our 320 million people in the country. Obviously, that leaves a lot of people that are still without an option for them immediately. What Pfizer's doing right now, what several other producers are doing right now, is manufacturing as many as they can. We guaranteed, that is the taxpayer, and through the CARES Act bill that we passed, we guaranteed 100 million doses that we would buy if it was effective. The first rounds of testing has come out, and people have seen it's proved over 90% effective. And Russell, you probably track all this and know this, but to compare that 90% effective rate to a typical flu shot is about 29% effective. This vaccine is showing upward 90% effective. That is very, very helpful. Not every vaccine is ever 100%. Even the measles vaccines and all of them have been around a long time. Are not 100% effective for everyone and every time. But that is a very high effectiveness rate for the first run at this. So we're hopeful in the next couple of months that'll roll out and start to accelerate.
And that's absolutely true. That 90% figure is very, very high, especially for, you know, an antiviral type vaccine. So there are some issues, though, and we need to face them squarely. One, this vaccine requires super refrigeration, like in the neighborhood of 100 degrees right below zero, I think, Fahrenheit. Two, and you mentioned this, we've only guaranteed to pay for about 100 million doses. We got a lot more people than that. And three, right, in order to get it out and distributed into the hands of people, it is going to take time. And obviously, we're going to prioritize how we do that. So my understanding is it takes two courses of the vaccine for it to be effective. Is that 100 million doses? Is that, you know, 50 million patients, or is that 100 million people who will get both doses?
100 million doses is 50 million people because you've got to have two rounds of that. We actually, as the federal taxpayer, actually purchased 700 million doses total. But we did that with six manufacturers early in the year and had these six manufacturers all compete. And each of them, we were doing around 100 million doses each. Now, some a little more, some a little less, but around that number. But it totals up, of the six of them, about 700 million doses. The reason we did that was we wanted all these companies to know, go try to create it. We're going to buy 100 million at the end of it regardless. Go get it. And that accelerates the process. And it also gets multiple companies competing against each other, because if they're the first one to get it done that's safe and effective, then we'll start buying more of that one as well. But we have a first 100 million of the first company that's come out, but there are other companies that are right behind it that also have current vaccine trials going on. Some of them are even in the later stages. We just haven't reached for them the final safety and effectiveness number that we have in the first round. So we will have enough doses for every single American, but it looks like it'll be closer to February or March before we'll actually have that when the other companies fall in. Now, if Pfizer comes back and says, yes, this is safe and effective, we can produce another 200 million right now, great, we'll accelerate right into that to be able to get as many as we can. But we're actually competing with the rest of the world that's also wanting the same vaccine. We understand that. But that's why we pre-purchased all these vaccines, to make sure that we could take care of Americans right off the bat.
And I believe Johnson & Johnson is pretty close behind, and their version of the vaccine does not require the super refrigeration and may not present the same number of difficulties in distribution and storage, which means we could have a couple of vaccines going, right, simultaneously by mid-next year.
No, I think we will. I do. I think by the time we get to March, we'll have four vaccines that'll all be in the public market. They'll all have a little different distribution system. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a single dose vaccine, but it probably is going to be February or March before it's ready. And so there's just different stages as there's different production on this. We have, as the federal government, we've worked on the distribution side. For instance, of Pfizer, this first one, they're actually doing the production, the research, the development, everything else. But we were guaranteeing all the distribution and all the purchasing of that first round of it. So we've already purchased syringes. We've purchased the alcohol swabs. We purchased the dry ice, got all that lined up that we'll need for the actual shipping and distribution of this to be able to get it out. So that distribution network has already been planned in advance on how to be able to get it out. But now it's a matter of actually saying they're going to produce enough to be able to accelerate it and get it out.
All right. So meanwhile, here in Oklahoma specifically, we have seen a huge spike in cases. Unfortunately, in fatalities, our 7-day rolling average literally doubled in a month. Our hospital administrators, our doctors are saying, look, we really need people to wear masks. And yet every single day, sir, and I'm not lying, every single day I have people tell me that masks don't work, that they just make you sicker, that it's all a bunch of lies that we're making up here at the radio station or at the Fox News Network or whatever. I've got to imagine that some calls are coming into your office. Sure. What are you telling folks?
Sure. What I'm telling folks is I wear a mask. And what they're hearing is from the very earliest days, Anthony Fauci at the very beginning of this said, if you wear a mask, you're more likely to touch your face and actually get the virus. He said that because at that time we had very few cases in the United States. And so people weren't spreading it from person to person. People were picking it up from other people and it was spreading. So in the earliest days, that was true, that you shouldn't wear a mask because you're more likely to get it. I said that in the earliest days, taking the CDC advice and others on that. I've now shifted and said, we're not in that phase anymore. We're in a different, very different phase of the virus. Now we're at a spot where the mask does help you not give it to someone else, since we know so many people are asymptomatic, and it helps protect you in some ways is what we're also seeing as well. So we just have to be able to pay attention to this as much as we can. It's still trying to go through the process, but it is still a virus. It's going to move. As we see with the flu every year, as we see with cold every year, it's going to move. We just have to be as attentive as we can through the process to be able to wash up, wear a mask, and then just pay attention to keeping some basic distancing.
All right. On the short-term side of things, there is still hope that Congress will act and that we'll get some sort of appropriations bill passed that will include some sort of stimulus or some sort of renewal of the PPP program. Can you update us on any of that?
I can, actually. This has been an issue that's rolled now for 4 months. That's been a back and forth to try to figure out what's going to happen. It finally all boiled down to right before the election. That the House is just not going to move before the election for fear of making Trump look good that he got something done. Fine, we're through that. The Senate's in session this week. The House is not in session this week. The House comes back in next week. They're doing leadership elections and then leaving. That really puts us to December the 1st to be able to restart again this whole process. Now, we have a lot of people talking back and forth on the staff level, on the member level in conversations, but there are some things that we should all agree need to be done. We need to finish up the funding for the distribution of vaccines. We need to finish up the funding for the next level of testing that has to get out again. We need additional funding for schools that are having such a difficult time being able to manage all this. We need additional funding for small businesses and the paycheck protection for very, very vulnerable small businesses. We need additional funding for our not-for-profits to be able to help them, because they're one of the front lines of our social safety net to be able to help people that are really hurting. So there are some things that we should all agree on. Liability protections should be an area we should be able to agree on, but for whatever reason, it's become contentious. But lots of businesses, schools, universities are all saying the same thing. Just tell us what the rules are for basic functioning. We're afraid of endless lawsuits coming just because we opened a day or two and trying to figure out what to do with this. And all those things we have included into a bill. We're trying to negotiate this out. Now, we're in a really different spot than what we were in March. And in March, literally the entire economy is shut down. Right now, we're at 93% employment in the country, 93%. So we've got to do what we can to be able to help those folks that are most vulnerable, that can't return to work, and those individuals that are unemployed right now that because their business is shut down. We've got to do something to help those folks. But we shouldn't do a large-scale, multi-trillion dollar borrowing for the future, because most people are back at work and they've kind of figured out how to be able to do it. The economy is not roaring, but it's moving, and we shouldn't just borrow a ton of money to try to accelerate it when we don't have to. So that's where we're trying to strike the balance right now.
All right. So in order for anything to happen at some point, both, you know, houses of Congress have to pass something, and then the president has to sign it. Yep. And so let's talk a little bit about the presidency right now. Today, President Trump, I believe, is in making his first public appearance in quite a while. We've just had an election. I know that there are several states that have not finalized their vote tally.
Right.
But we have seen pretty clear projection of what the results are going to be. I've been tracking what legal action has been taken so far. I've seen, I think, six states in which there are challenges of one nature or another. I'm not going to lie. I'm getting every day. Here we go again. We're hearing from people who are telling us that we're breaking the law by calling Joe Biden the president elect. Now, I don't know how you would answer those calls if you were in this office, but I am curious what you think, because honestly, the president has he's golfed a couple times, but he hadn't seemed to be doing much the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, he has been on the phone. He's been back and forth with his attorneys. He's meeting with his campaign team. He's trying to be able to finish that out. Obviously, he has some other issues that you have to deal with as president every single day that are not in the public eye. But between the two of them, I would tell you, if the roles were reversed, Joe Biden would be in court right now, and President Trump would say, "I'm the president-elect, and we're moving on." So I get it. Joe Biden is at a spot to say, I'm ahead in all these states. The networks have already called it. I'm going to start functioning like I'm the president-elect. Though nothing's been certified, GSA, it's the Government Services Administration, they've not certified it. The states haven't certified it. But the projections are out there. And so Joe Biden's entirely within his right to say, hey, it looks like I'm going to be president. I'm going to start functioning that way. President of the United States, President Trump, is also fully within his right to say, hey, it's within a half a percentage point. In fact, in one state, it's within a quarter of a percentage point. It's very close, and the votes are still coming in, and there's still military ballots outstanding, and there's still some dispute in some of these precincts just in the first round of counting, much less any recounts that'll start. And Georgia has already announced that it was so close that Georgia's going to start a recount immediately to be able to go through to try to verify all this. All of that's still going on in the background. So it'll take a couple days still to be able to get through all this. And everyone will kind of play their position and say, this is where I am on it. I've just said, I'm going to wait this out. I totally understand where President Trump is coming from. I totally understand where Joe Biden's coming from. I get that at that point. But there are still lots of questions on this. And I would tell you, my biggest frustration of all of this is, this shows again how good Oklahoma's election system is and how poor many other states are. They're secure in their election as far as from foreign interference, but they didn't do the work to be able to make sure that they can just operate efficiently. They were so worried about the pandemic that now that they have created these unstable environments, there's no reason any state should have received ballots after 7 p.m. on election day. We don't in Oklahoma. We give weeks for people to mail in a ballot. We give all kinds of time to do in-person absentee voting and then day of voting. We get lots of options for people to be able to do that. 5 hours after the polls close, we know who won or lost a race. We're now more than a week after the election in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Nevada, and Arizona can't even tell us how many more ballots are coming. So that does not create a stable environment for us as a country. So, best thing that we can do is help these states fix their system so we don't have this again.
Well, that is that's fair. It could also be argued that it was, you know, a lot of Republican initiatives that sort of gummed up the works and confused the rules. Changing when the deadline is after some people have already mailed their ballots, things like that. And I don't think any of those initiatives were undertaken by Democrats. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's a pretty good split, actually, in this. There have been folks that have worked on this for several months leading up into this. And then there's a situation like Pennsylvania where the legislature says, we're not going to change the date. You have to receive it all by election day. And then Pennsylvania courts stepped in and said, no, it's a pandemic. We were going to give people extra days to be able to send it in. And that's been probably the most contentious of all of them, because the court said one thing and the legislature said another. State law says that it has to be received by election day, and the courts just extended it arbitrarily. That's the biggest constitutional issue, because according to the United States Constitution, the legislature decides on the days of elections and how it's done, not the courts in the states. And so that's a long-term constitutional issue on what happened in Pennsylvania. But in areas like Georgia, some precincts were given the latitude to be able to go one way and some the other. And so you've got areas in Atlanta and Macon that they had one set of rules, for instance, weekend voting, that they were doing weekend voting and others were not. They also have very loose rules on residency, where you have individuals that don't appear to actually be residents of Georgia, but that are registered and voting in Georgia. And we're not just talking about college students that, you know, are in Georgia, but they're actually official residents somewhere else. We're talking about people that actually don't reside there. And so there are those challenges that are ongoing right now that we're trying to figure out what happened here. How did this actually occur? Is this something malicious or is this just sloppy state law that either way has to be fixed long term, but doesn't necessarily affect an election?
Was that a new state law? Or was that
extant? Those are old. No, those
okay.
are old.
That was the law when people went to vote in the state of Georgia. So right. They did not vote illegally.
Well, that again, on those issues, no, that's not an illegal vote. I can't say on the other issues because I'm not tracking those. That all happens in states. People have asked me, do you have evidence of that? I was like, no, because I live in Oklahoma and I'm not tracking this. There are questions that are out there and social media is covered up with people saying this or that, or I've got a video of, or somebody has a sworn affidavit. Okay, fine. There's also an army of lawyers that are chasing every one of those down. They can go answer the question. There's an appropriate time for them to be able to ask, an appropriate place to get that question answered. My hope is all the folks that are tracking all of those issues that are out there also check it out later once it's actually confirmed. Did that happen? The famous Sharpie votes in Arizona that people said if you voted with a Sharpie, it got kicked out, was a social media buzz for 36 hours. And then they found out it's actually not true. So all of those things will get checked out, get confirmed, actually go through the legal process and are either true or false. And then they'll move on based on whether true or false.
So meanwhile, you know, we've got a recount in one state, Georgia, right. Which is triggered right. automatically.
That's correct.
And that's it. And you know, sir, because you're a well-educated, well-read man, that recounts just don't change elections. It's almost unheard of. They had a recount in Wisconsin in 2016. What did they end up doing? They ended up, I believe, giving Mr. Trump about 100 more votes, if memory serves. There is an American public right now sitting around going, all I want to know is what is next? When are we going to have some stability? When are we going to be able to get over the chaos and the confusion and just have some sanity? And why is this process being drug out? If when there doesn't seem to be, and this is me talking now, there sure. doesn't seem to be any smoke, much less fire, of any kind of voter fraud or miscalculations or miscounts that would alter the tallies that I'm seeing being reported by these state election boards.
Right. So I would tell you, I don't know of anything. I know a lot of folks have made accusations and they're trying to peel it back and see if there's a there and try to evaluate it. I remind people in 2000, Al Gore called for 4 recounts in Florida. So that it was 4 times there was a recount in Florida that Al Gore requested. And then he challenged those results twice to the Supreme Court. So it was 35 days total that we were waiting as a nation with hanging chads and all of those wonderful things. And does a dimple count as intent in all of those challenges? So that happened over the course of a month in 2000. We survived it as a nation. We'll survive this as well, because at the end of it, we will have a declaration of president. It is important for the 71 million plus people that voted for President Trump that at the end of it, they know all of their questions were answered and that there is a president that was actually duly elected. If you cut that off early, then you've got a huge percentage of Americans that are saying, oh, you cut it off because you knew. And then the conspiracy theories fly after that.
The conspiracy theories—they're
already going.
Flying.
I know, they never stop. But they never stop at that point. If we don't actually check it out, then it never stops. The best thing that we can do right now is to go through the legal process, allow the president to be able to ask every question he wants to be able to ask, to go through that legal process, get real answers at it, because there is a date certain that's in December that the electors meet. And that everything gets certified. And so the clock is ticking to be able to get that established. In the meantime, Joe Biden can continue to be able to function and say, I'm the president-elect. And great, if you want to say that, go do it. And to be able to do your preparation work. The president can say, not so fast. I've got questions to answer. Great, go ask them. And then walk through this as a nation.
Meantime, there's no transition cooperation at all. Yeah. Meantime, our United States ambassadors and diplomats overseas are smacking their heads going, what did our Secretary of State just say? What am I supposed to be telling leaders of foreign countries that there's going to be a second Trump administration? Is that the official policy of the United States government? And I got to tell you, national security is a concern because Mr. Biden is not getting the briefings that a president-elect would normally be getting at this stage in the process.
Yeah, and that should be resolved by Friday. GSA has to certify that election to start turning it around. The first day they can do that on the calendar is Friday. And when that occurs, they should actually step in. And I would tell you, I'm on a committee of oversight. I've already started engaging in this area. My first question was in 2000, what occurred in 2000 during that whole challenge? And what happened was President Clinton made available to, at that time, George Bush, the governor at that point, still in the process of running, the availability to start getting the briefings and to do that. There's nothing wrong with Vice President Biden getting the briefings to be able to prepare himself and so that he can be ready. The president's already getting those. There's nothing wrong with the former vice president getting those. Kamala Harris is on the Intelligence Committee. She has all the clearances that she needs to be able to do that. There is no loss from him getting the briefings and to be able to do that. And if that's not occurring by Friday, I will step in as well and to be able to push and to say this needs to occur so that regardless of the outcome of the election, whichever way that it goes, people can be ready for that actual task.
Well, and you make a great point. The GSA is on the clock. The Electoral College is on the clock. Congress is on the clock because ultimately what it comes down to, if I know my electoral process, and I admit I'm no expert, but I believe it is a vote of Congress that certifies the votes of the Electoral College. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. So each of the state legislatures, they certify these are the votes that we're sitting in for the Electoral College. It comes to Congress. We actually open up the envelopes. There's a formal reading of the envelopes with a joint session of Congress to be able to go through it, to be able to certify all that. There's a confirmation. Yes, all of our numbers match. That person's elected. If no one gets to 270 votes or there's no agreement on that, then the presidential election gets thrown into the House of Representatives and the vice president gets thrown into the Senate, which our nation has also done. But I don't think that's going to happen this time. We're not even close to that moment.
Well, there are some concerns about some moves at the Pentagon and the firing of the Secretary of Defense. I mean, that people are getting scared, sir. I'm not going to lie. So, I mean, they want to hear that there's going to be a peaceful transition of power in the United States of America. And I would imagine that you would try to reassure them.
Yep. I can assure you there will be a peaceful transition of power in the United States. I don't hear things other than some of the national media circles that are constantly spinning that Trump won't relent, Trump won't relent. When I talk to his team and I talk to the folks around him, they say that's absolutely absurd. We just want to know all the votes have been counted, that these are legal votes. It is within our right to be able to do that, and we're going to do that. But there is no question that there'll be a peaceful transition of power. If Joe Biden is declared the winner, then Joe Biden will be sworn in as the next president of the United States on January the 20th. If he is not the winner, they will go through all the legal challenges and evaluate that and determine, oh, no, there was a major problem in this. Then we will have all that turmoil as a country to be able to expose it and to be able to say this is what occurred and he's not being sworn in. But at the end of it, we will have a peaceful transition of power as a country. That's who we are and that's what we're all about. And so I really have no question on that at all. And what's happening with Secretary Esper was obviously long planned. And had been out there for a while to know that this was going to happen. It is not just a single petty event from months ago that the media is portraying. I've already been in conversation with some of the White House leadership on that. And this was a culmination of multiple issues with Esper. And so the president had already said, I'm going to make the change and is making the change and already had someone queued up and ready to go that was very competent to be able to take on that task. And so that is what occurred. That is within the president's prerogative to do that. That's I would not have true. Made that change with the next 2 months, but it was a clear signal with preparation behind the scenes for a good transition at the Pentagon.
So, and you've been so generous with your time, Senator. I appreciate it. There's one more quick topic I just want to touch on real quick, and that is NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine's resignation. So I spoke with Administrator Bridenstine a few days ago, and I'm going to tell you off the record. Well, I guess we're kind of on the record at the moment, but my conversation with him was off the record. But I'll tell you part of my half of it, which was, dude, is there anybody who could do a better job? Because you know I know a lot of people said, oh, he's a politician, he's not a scientist. Yeah. Mr. Bridenstine's a Navy pilot, a super smart guy, and I don't know. I think he's done a fantastic job. This is all, again, my personal opinion. Yep. Have you spoken with him at all?
I haven't spoken to him in the last couple of weeks. We spoke not long ago. We've stayed in contact through this time period, but Jim Bridenstine has done a remarkable job as the administrator of NASA. And what's been interesting to me is there were a lot of Democrats in the Senate that voted against him for confirmation, saying he's a Republican congressman, he's a Trump supporter, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to support him. Then he came in and showed real competence. At every single hearing, he showed professionalism and competence. And multiple Democrat senators came to me and said, I voted against him. If I would have known now what I knew then, I would have voted for him because he's won me over with how he's running NASA, what he's accomplishing, and the vision that he's casting is right on what we needed for this season.
And I told him, are you seriously telling me that if you were asked to serve again under a Biden administration, you wouldn't do it? And he said, no, the way I feel right now, I just, you know, and I don't know, I guess I'm saying, I think that's a shame, but you know, I hate to see talent like that go probably into the private sector. I mean, he'll land on his feet. Man could land an airplane on an aircraft carrier at night. I'm sure he'll survive this. Yes.
Yeah.
Anything else on your? Go ahead.
He is right, by the way, in the sense that whoever is running NASA has to have the confidence and the connection, especially with the Vice President of the United States. That was the unique connection that he had with Mike Pence, that Mike Pence really trusted him, really liked him, and obviously the president was as well, but the vice president typically gets NASA as far as the assignments in most administrations. And so the key for him was, does he have the vice president's trust and ear? And if he doesn't, it's hard to be able to ask for budget requests. It's hard to be able to talk through those things if you're not a trusted partner of the vice president. And so that's a decision that he has to make on that. Quite frankly, in every change of every administration, every single individual that was appointed by that previous president, whether it's an ambassador or any other role, typically offers their resignation to the new president and says, I will stay if you choose for me to, but here's my resignation if you choose for me to leave as well. It's your prerogative. You are the new president.
The pro forma, I think they call it, the pro forma resignation. It's just how things are generally done. But hey, it's 2020. Nothing seems to be getting done like it used to these days.
Hey, listen, I'm telling everybody, 2020 is just a practice round for 2021.
Oh, so. I don't know if that's good news or not, Senator. So, all right. Well, listen, again, you've been so very generous with your time. And man, I love chatting with you because you're not only connected, but you're smart and well-spoken. So I'll just butter your toast a little bit right there. But is there anything else on your mind, just kind of generally, that you want folks to be thinking about? As we were talking, I just saw another breaking news headline. Coronavirus hospitalizations have gone up 50% nationally in the last 2 weeks. I cannot stress enough to people that we have got to get serious about wearing masks and social distancing and not gathering for a big Christmas family dinner. I'm sorry, it sucks, but man, we are not going to see a vaccine for several months. We've got to do something in the meantime. So I'm sorry, I'll leave you an open mic, sir. You can talk about anything you want.
That's all right. I would just tell you that in the next couple of weeks, when you get through December, we've got 12 appropriation bills to get through the House and the Senate. Jim Inhofe's bill on national defense has got to get through. We have COVID related bills that are moving through. We have additional judges that are moving through the Senate. So there's a lot that's happening in the Senate and in the House over the next couple of months that there'll still be activity behind the scenes. So while people are focused on the elections, we're still in session and we still got to be able to finish out the work that needs to be done. And so it'll still be a noisy season. And right now, there are only two Senate races that are left in the country unresolved, and it's the two races in Georgia. And for political junkies that are out there, the majority of the Senate will be dependent on who wins these two races in Georgia. It's 50-48 right now, 50 Republicans, 48 Democrats. If Joe Biden is elected, which it looks like he is elected as president, that means if it's a 50-50 Senate, Kamala Harris is the one who breaks the tie. Yep. And so it determines whether Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer is the majority leader, who sets the directions of the committees, who takes up what bills. Even if the number is 50-50, in this setting, who the president is matters for breaking that tie in leadership of the Senate. So there'll be a lot of attention on Georgia and for that race in January the 5th. So for the unfortunate things for the people of Georgia, the coal in their stocking for Christmas is going to be campaign commercials that'll be running endlessly.
First a recount, December. Followed by two Senate runoff, not one, but two Senate two. Runoff races. Yep. Well, and I'll say this, and I've been hearing this from the left as well, is that, you know, maybe a slim United States Senate majority by the Republicans would not be a terrible thing. Because to get things passed, to get things going, I mean, we've mentioned it earlier, you got to have both houses on board and a presidential right. signature. So it's a, I guess, a handbrake, if you will.
It is.
On you know, any sort of real ultra-leftist sort of agenda that might be put forward by the House. And I'm just spitballing here, but, you know, I'm making this
up.
We
watched that in 2011. Americans responded by flipping the House in 2010. And 2011 came in. That's when the Budget Control Act kicked in. We actually started controlling spending again. We had a Republican House, Democrat Senate, Democrat White House. They all sat down together and had to be able to address some of the spending issues and did make a decade-long transition in how our spending was done. And it was a real change that occurred that happened in divided government. So it can be productive. It can force everyone to say, we got to be able to look at these serious things and come to some agreement. So if that's what the American people send, that's what we're going to do. And so I'm not pessimistic about that, but it is still unresolved for us at this moment.
All right, sir. Well, I don't get to talk to you that often, so I will wish you a happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, and hopefully we'll talk again before too long.
Yep, hope so as well. And look forward to that. Take care, Russell.
Thank Allie for setting this up for me. Much appreciated.
Will do.
Stay safe,
bye-bye.
Brother. Bye. You've been listening to KRMG In Depth, the podcast.
I'm always looking for stories about the people, places, and politics of Oklahoma. I'm easy to find on Facebook, or you can always email me and the entire KRMG news team. The email address is news@krmg.com. I'm Russell Mills. Thanks for the listen.